Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nedolsky, with my co-host, Dr. Carl Berendocrinologist. And with us, we have the greatest sleep doctor to ever walk the planet, Dr. Shelby Harris. She's actually my very own sleep doctor, and I refer all my patients to her book. Can't wait to talk to her about all things sleep today. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Shelby.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. I really appreciate all you do in this space, for sure.
Yeah, we love you. I mean, I think I found you, maybe Dr. Jen Gunter, who's always on our podcast. I think she may have followed you. I was like, I'm having some sleep troubles. I'm just going to schedule. I'm going to message
Dr.
Shelby. And so I was like, you know what? We haven't had a sleep specialist on the podcast. And you are a PsyD,
Let her describe the difference between that and like the medical sleep medicine docs.
So I'm a psychologist by training. I still see some general therapy patients, but there's PhDs and PsyDs. PsyD is a doctor of psychology, basically meaning that I do more clinical work. Than my training was much more clinically based than doing a lot of research on top of it. I still did research, but not as much as someone with a PhD might have. So I did a lot of clinical training.
Very cool. All right. And then you subspecialized into sleep.
Yeah. I have a board certification in behavioral sleep medicine. So what that is like, in sleep is a big umbrella, and there's a lot of MDs who are board certified in sleep medicine. And then under there is the subspecialty of behavioral sleep medicine, which is a lot of people who are like myself, who are therapists, psychologists, who work with, like, in conjunction with the MD sleep specialist. Like, I worked in a sleep center for almost 15 years, and we work with patients without using medication, using evidence-based techniques to then improve sleep as well.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So cool.
Here's a question for you, because I assume Spencer does too, but we in endocrinology, I send a lot of people to sleep medicine. Now, obviously, a lot of our patients are struggling with sleep apnea, but as you can imagine, and we can talk about sleep and circadian rhythms and hormones, you know, there's a lot of issues with sleep in my clinic. And so I do send a lot of people to sleep medicine, not just for sleep apnea. So I'm hopeful that a lot of those places have somebody like you. Is that a pretty common thing, or is that not always across the board? I don't know that I necessarily always get any reports back on that, but
it is very unusual to have, I mean, not unheard of. There's more and more. I mean, when I started working at the sleep center in Montefiore many, many years ago, there were very few people embedded within sleep centers. But what you're looking for is really, I mean, if you're going for an apnea eval, a sleep lab is generally fine. But we consider sleep centers, comprehensive sleep centers, to really have, like, we worked with ENT, Palm, child sleep. We had psychology like myself. So they're much more comprehensive with all different people on board. Bigger centers tend to have them, but not everyone.
Mm. Yeah, so your patients are probably getting drugged up.
Yeah, I see. Right, it's funny. Even though I work without medication, 90% of my patients are coming to me on high levels of medication that are either working for them, but they want to get off them or need to get off them, or they're not working so well and they want someone to help kind of optimize everything for themselves.
What are the most common, like, what's the most common sleep issue? Like, is it insomnia? Is that what you usually,
yeah, other than, say, sleep apnea, I guess? Like,
I mean, sleep apnea is like everywhere. Yeah, insomnia. So insomnia, the rates of insomnia in general are about 40 to 50% of people have some kind of subacute or a symptom of insomnia here and there. And then upwards of 15% of the population has chronic insomnia, which is like three or more nights a week, going on for a month to be short-term, 3 months for long-term. So it's a huge problem.
And what are the definitions of what would qualify as insomnia? Like, about, like, a other than like how many days a week, but like,
well, yeah, how do you define it? What's the clinical criteria? And maybe it's, you know, like constipation. It's a, like a real, you know, yeah, the GI guys get into that.
Yeah, I think when it comes to insomnia, the problem, I think the way that our society talks about sleep, especially with social media now, is like, we want to fix everything. We should have perfect sleep or else all these terrible things are going to happen. And I use the criteria all the time with my patients to help understand that there is a normal spectrum of not having perfect sleep every single night. So it's really, like I was saying, three or more nights of trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, or waking up early than you'd like to. Now, what does trouble mean, right? So some diagnostic criteria or manuals will say 30 minutes. If it's more than 30 minutes, you meet the criteria for insomnia. But believe it or not, in the sleep medicine, the ICSD, which is what we use, that actually doesn't have a specific amount of time built into it. Because really, I mean, if someone's 29 minutes versus 31 minutes, are we going to diagnose them? And it's a lot of perception. So it's really three or more nights a week of poor sleep. But also, is it causing a problem for you? So if you're 29 minutes versus 31, but 31, it's really you're annoyed by it. You're noticing you're having trouble with concentration, memory, whatever it might be, irritability the next day. You're frustrated, even can be trouble. Then, okay, we're going to work on improving it. But I like the criteria because it's three or more nights a week for at least a month to be short-term insomnia. It tells people that we're not looking for perfect sleep 7 nights a week. That would be wonderful, but it's within normal limits to have a bad night here and there. I don't sleep perfect every single night. And I think the way that we talk about it in our culture nowadays is actually making people think that sleep has to be perfect. And it's actually making some people worse when it comes to their insomnia. They're worrying about it more.
I was going to say, because so kind of to your definition, and this is kind of why I brought up the constipation, I often ask patients, in some of these similar realms, like analogy type issues, is it causing distress? That's kind of what you're getting at, like, right? And so Spencer and I can probably talk about our history of insomnia. I think going to your point of it's causing more stress when people think that it has to be perfect. We've always been sort of like anal about our health since we were little kids. I mean, our parents were, you know, were on us, which certainly helped us in a lot of ways. I think, you know, dad was always like, you got to get our 8 hours of sleep. It's a big deal. And so I always had, yes, we can get into why we had anxiety growing up, but, you know, I had issues sleeping growing up and in college and in my young adulthood, and then I'd get really uptight about it. So then because I think I'm causing problems to my health, and then it's a vicious cycle, and then I get mad, and then I'm up all night, and then it does cause me distress. And actually, in my more recent adult years, I've been better, actually, because I've been trying to sort of pull back my anxiety about being perfect in my health, which maybe can swing both ways. But I don't know. That's just interesting that you brought that up. Spencer, do you have any similar?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I would message Dr. Shelby and I'm like, I had a bad night. She's like, well, that's not that don't even meet the definition. And I was like, oh, okay. So now it helps going like, oh, whatever. One bad night a month or every other month is fine.
Yeah.
Like, even though I'm like, oh, I feel like crap the next day.
And then it ends up helping, hopefully not have it as a recurring thing. I feel like, relaxing that uptightness for me has improved my sleep, actually.
Yeah. And I think that when I think about when I first started in the field, most of the referrals that I were getting and the patients that were coming in were like, they had significant sleep issues. They'd been going on for decades. And it was really like a doctor's like, finally, you need to do something about it. And now I'm getting, which is good, but sometimes almost too much. I'm getting these younger patients who are very health conscious, which I love that they're thinking about it. But they're like, I have a night here and there. And I'm just like, you know what? Look, it's okay. And so it's fascinating. Or I'm getting more patients that are like, I'm sleeping okay, but I'm really worried that it's not perfect enough that I'm going to end up getting Alzheimer's down the road or having all these other things happen. So there's more like forward thinking about it, which is interesting that really didn't exist 10, 15 years ago in my practice.
What are you seeing more of? Is it falling asleep or waking up at 3 a.m. and not being able to fall back asleep?
It's a mix. I don't think there's one versus another. And a lot of people, it kind of starts off as one and then kind of shifts and morphs to the other. In my menopausal population, it's a lot of like waking up at night, flashes.
That's what I'm seeing.
That's why we treat them. Yeah. I mean, we obviously in our world, we see a lot of that. But well, OK, so then maybe we need to, you know, go backwards a little bit, because, you know, we're talking about how maybe some people are, and maybe we have been, almost over uptight about having perfect sleep for health. What are the basics as to why do we need good sleep, like for our health, all the different things that are, you know, really pretty established reasons why we do need good sleep and sleep hygiene and all that stuff?
Yeah, people always talk about sleep as like one of the pillars of health. Mm-hmm. I don't think about it as a pillar. I think about it as the bedrock. So like nothing else is going to stick really well unless you have good sleep as the basis. And when I'm talking about good sleep, it's not just enough sleep. It's also quality and timing. Mm-hmm. Like that's important a lot of times, or most of the time. So what is it important for? I always think of them like head to toe, right? Cognitive functioning, memory, cardiovascular health, metabolic health. Weight, exercise, energy, reduction of issues with when it comes to injury, right? Or injury repair. It's just everything from the bottom up in our body is impacted in a good way from a good night's sleep.
Yeah, I feel like crap if I don't sleep. I hate it. And so
what are the basic recommendations for adults? And maybe, I don't know, do you do kids and adolescents?
Yeah, I work with babies through older adults. Yeah.
Yeah. So what are the basic recommendations for most people, the general population of those?
So recommendations meaning like
for the amount of sleep, the consistency, the basic sleep hygiene things, because I think a lot of people have really bad sleep hygiene for a variety of reasons. So I'm sure you'll have to kind of go through all those things and reiterate them for patients, because we go through that a lot in our world.
Yes. Timing, generally between 7 to 9 hours for the majority of the population, even 6 to 9 hours is somewhat acceptable. So when we talk about like the 8, they're literally just picking that number because it's in the middle. It's easy to report.
Which I used to be really uptight about that. And now I'm not. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really in that range. And I always think about like shoe size, right? Everyone has a different shoe size, but we all kind of congregate in the same area. So that's how you have to think about it. So there's that range. There are some people that are outliers. So some people need more and some people are okay with a little bit less, but generally in that range. Now, when we're talking about timing, so consistency. So if you're happy with going to bed around the same time, waking up around the same time, it's working in your life, that's all what we're looking for. So there was a whole paper that came out in the Journal of Sleep Health, I want to say like a year and a half, 2 years ago, that was a consensus paper. And it was wonderful because it really said like the first thing we need to think about is the timing, consistency of our sleep-wake timing, more so than amount of time and quality of sleep. We need to think about the consistency. And a lot of people don't think about that. They think, oh, well, I just, whatever time I go to bed, I'm going to count 8 hours from then and then just get up the next morning. And that's not how our bodies, our circadian rhythms in our body are meant to actually work. So consistency. And when I say consistency, it's like within a half hour, hour. It doesn't have to be like I'm up exactly at 8 a.m. on the dot, but within some reasonable range. And then sleep hygiene, right? So sleep hygiene, I always say this too, it's like dental hygiene, brushing your teeth, flossing. We want to do those every day. My colleague, Rachel Mamber, always talked about this. And she said, like, look, when you get a cavity though, you can't brush the cavity away. So sleep hygiene is like basic stuff we need to do. And if that's not enough, and we'll go through what that is, then you need to up the ante with what the treatments are. So we think about daytime stuff, right? Like getting up at the same time, getting light, getting movement during the day. Caffeine is fine for many people, but earlier in the day, 1 to 2 cups. I mean, I love my coffee. I'm not going to give that up.
Yeah. If I drink coffee in the afternoon, I will just sort of not sleep well.
Yeah.
And then our dad drinks it at bedtime. It goes to bed and he's fine.
Yeah, that's the thing that's so baffling to me. There are some people who can, there are actually blood tests that you can do where you can figure out if someone's more sensitive to caffeine, but we're not doing that in practice. So we usually will say like 8 hours before bed to limit it, 12 hours. The older you get, you metabolize caffeine slower, so it can really impact with older adults a lot more.
Dad just doesn't give a damn.
He doesn't give a shit.
Right.
He's amazing.
But then like, okay, so caffeine, and then I still can't wrap my head around the cultures that are drinking, you know, an espresso or cappuccino full of caffeine at night. And then we think about alcohol, right? So alcohol, a lot of people will use alcohol as a sedative, but it's really, it impacts the sleep quality, the quantity you're getting. It diminishes REM sleep that you're getting. So alcohol within 3 hours, cut it out. 3 hours before bed, cut out heavy meals. You can have a small, I have a small snack before bed, an hour before bed. That's fine. But cutting out heavy meals, and then also liquids. If you have to take medication at night, small amount of liquid, not too much, because then you'll have to wake up to urinate. We also think about things like exercise, the timing of exercise. So during the day is great, even 4 to 6 hours before bed. For some people who have trouble falling asleep at night, that time range, which is like impossible for many people, myself included, but that can be helpful for falling asleep. But within 3 hours, stay away from vigorous exercise. And then things like keeping the room quiet, dark, cool, comfortable. I would say like a cave. I mean, that's kind of how it should be, but a cave you want to be in. And then the whole thing with screens is actually quite debated in the field.
Okay.
You know, like there are people who are like, no screens at all. I mean, I'd love that. I'd love it if people just gave up the screens. But the amount of time that it actually can really delay sleep for from the blue light is not super drastic. It's more of using screens while you're supposed to be sleeping during your sleep period. And then also, like, what are you looking at on your phone, right? It's a lot of times it's like, are you getting
Spencer? Jesus.
I don't know.
I know what you're looking at.
You're all the reels you're sending me.
So it's like, yeah, you know, like, remember, all this stuff is meant to be addictive, right? So we're scrolling and then like, you know, like me and Netflix, I'll just like have it keep playing and then I lose track of the time. Or is it something you're getting caught in work emails or whatever that are so stimulating, then you have trouble falling asleep. So it's not just the light, it's the content of what you're looking at.
So here's a question, because that is a big question for me, because I was always, and I tell literally my kids this when they're looking at their phones, I'm like, no, the blue light's going to screw up your sleep right before bedtime. Tell us a little bit more about the whole blue light thing, because that's different than what's on like a TV. So like if we're in bed and we're watching a nighttime show, is that from, you know, 15 feet away, is that blue light, or is the blue light only from like phones? I don't know.
It's still blue lights, but that's where like all the like, it's very subtle. And the difference is like, if someone's going to say, well, I mean, I have a lot of younger patients, it's interesting, who really want to watch The Office and Friends at night to like quiet their brain down. I'm like, I watched that in high school. So they're all watching it now, discovering it. And
well, that's Seinfeld. Come on.
I know, right? Seinfeld. Too. Jeez. But the funny thing is they're all watching it like on their phone in their face. Wow. And then I'm like, can you get it? Can you watch it on a TV somewhere else? And then they look at me like I'm crazy having a TV. I'm like, well, put your laptop further away.
My God.
Right? It's not a lot of data on like the distance and the brightness. And some people just turn the brightness down. But really, it's like if it's calming to you and it's not having you stay up longer, then it's fine. The idea, the original idea, and that a lot of people still ascribe to it, it's just the research is very mixed on it. The original idea is that the blue light, whether it's far away, it's how intense it is, right? It's suppressing your melatonin that your brain is naturally making, right? And so that can definitely, melatonin makes you sleepy. And that's what sets the whole sequela of going to bed and staying asleep throughout the night. So it's not great, but like even the original study that looked at blue light, and it was done by Charles Seisler at Harvard. I can't remember. It was maybe 15, 20 years ago. It showed that blue light delayed sleep by 11 minutes when people were using it at the bed. But the way people talk about it is like you're going to be up all night long. So I tend to be like, let's get rid of the screens if we can. But if you're so like you have to listen to Friends, put it further away and then we'll like maybe taper you off of it a bit.
But what about the Flux app on your that's supposed to change it to?
Yeah, that's a great thing. So if you're going to be on your computer, right, a lot of people are using that and have for a long time. That actually has some data behind it to really be blocking light. So if you find that you're more sensitive to it, the Flux, F.LUX, I never know how to say it.
Well, geez.
That is actually a really good thing. There's really not good evidence for like screen time or the like stuff on your phone that turns it to like night mode. There's not really great evidence for that stuff.
Well, that's remarkable, because the last time I used a Flux capacitor, I ended up in 1984.
There you go.
Hey, who are you calling yellow?
God,
nobody calls me
chicken. I'm old. I don't know what the heck you guys are talking about.
It's just an app that changes Flux things capacitors. More orange and warm as opposed to blue and whatever. I don't know.
But there was actually data suggesting that it can be helpful. That's like one of the few things that has actually really been studied. People, they had it on computers for a long time before it was apps. So people would do that at night when they're doing work, but I'm also kind of like, you're also doing work. So like, that's not helpful either, right?
Yeah, I'd say the most stimulating. Yeah, it's more so like stimulating work as opposed to just messing around and
exactly.
So here's a question I have. Now, you know, people are going to love this, but it's an honest question. So you talk about exercise. Now, there's also, speaking of Seinfeld, there was an episode where they talked about, you know, people sleeping together, sexual activity, and he says, "Well, that's not actually sleep." You know, that's what Jerry said. So I've actually always wondered, people, you know, the sleep medicine sort of mantra, I think in general, has always said your bedroom is for sleeping and sexual activity kind of thing, not for TVs, right? Is that kind of a historic thing in sleep medicine? Or at least I feel like that's what I've always been taught.
And then
I feel like, you know, somewhat being a little bit of a jokester, like say in residency when the, you know, the attending doctor would say something like that, and I say, well, but wait a second. What if you're like having like vigorous sexual activity and it's like exercise. I mean, if you end up like really winded and it's like an intensive exercise, like a high intensity exercise training, you talked about, you know, high intensity exercise right before bed. Is there something to that? I know people think it's funny, but like, it's a pretty sincere
30
question.
Seconds count as vigorous. And that's
Think about how hard, like, think about that's like a lap around, like a 200 meter sprint.
Yes. It's interesting when it comes to sex, like But we used to have this question at Montefiore, our intake packet, and I ask it more with patients. I don't really have it in my intake packet anymore, but it was like, does sex help you or make it harder for you to sleep? And what we find is it's not across the board, but for women, it actually makes it harder for them to sleep at night. And for men, they actually find it helps them sleep a lot of times. So, but it's not like, we're not saying don't do that, because some people actually find that it's really useful.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So yeah, that's just total individualization then.
As
a lot of things
and
are.
The idea of like the bed is for sleep and sex, that's called stimulus control. So stimulus, you're controlling the bed stimulus for sleep and sex only. That is also like, that is that's been around since the 70s as a rule in sleep medicine. But we've actually, it's interesting, the pandemic has made some of us kind of soften a bit on it, because a lot of people were in one space. They didn't, like, they had to work in their bedroom. They had to do all these other things. I worked in Manhattan with so many, and I still do, with so many people who live in studio apartments. So it's like, it's really more of don't live your life in your bed. Don't spend all your time in your bed. And if you find that you're in your bed and you're trying to force sleep to happen, you're anxious, you have a very busy brain, you just can't turn off and you're frustrated, that's when you want to get out. A lot of times people just have this knee-jerk reaction to get right out of bed, but you might actually be in and out of sleep and not realize it.
Yeah. So what do you do when people are doing all the sleep hygiene things and then they still are having troubles falling asleep and they're, you know, it may not be 3 days a week, but it's like, you know, a day or two a week.
And and do you initiate like a medical evaluation? So again, in our world, we're thinking, you know, my patients with thyroid disease disorders and stuff like that. I mean, even in rarely things like, you know, Cushing's and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of people will come to me in my practice after having kind of talked to primary care or endocrinology or some other specialist. A lot of people are sent to me from sleep medicine, honestly. And they're fine that there's nothing else going on. But if they come to me and they've never seen anyone else, I'm going to ask similar questions. And if I get any kind of a spidey sense that we need to get that evaluated, I'll refer out for those things. But a lot of times the sleep hygiene alone is not going to fix chronic sleep issues. It just doesn't. So that's when I evaluate for apnea. I'll ask them some basic questions, because that's often going on, especially for the middle of the night awakenings and the unrefreshing sleep. And then I will initiate usually like CBT for insomnia if there's something going on there. So it's not just sleep hygiene, it's limiting time in bed. It's working on the worries about sleep, trying to force sleep to happen. And then the other big thing I do is, especially when it comes to the falling asleep issue, that's like having trouble falling asleep, I'll do a good assessment of whether I think an actual circadian rhythm disorder is going on. So can they actually sleep 7-8 hours, but it's on a delayed time schedule and they just have to keep getting up early to go to work or for the kids or whatever, when it looks like insomnia, because that often is getting misdiagnosed a lot too. But yeah, we'll do a medical eval, I'll refer to sleep medicine wherever I feel like needs to, but we'll still kind of change some of the other behaviors at the same time.
Spencer, is that what you said you worked with her on? You had this a little bit of a circadian issue. You talked about how you were like,
I was going to bed probably not tired enough.
Yeah. Okay.
It goes against common sense, but I'm telling a lot of my insomnia patients, go to bed a bit later. Stop following this. You have to be in bed 8-9 hours, because for some people that ends up having trouble falling asleep and then like broken sleep throughout the night.
Yeah. So now instead of like 10:30, I'm like 11:30.
Wow.
I'm tired.
And you still get up pretty early, right?
Yeah. I mean, I get up around 6 7.
Something or
7. I don't get around 6, but.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So then what are kind of the most common sort of underlying organic causes? Obviously, like I said, thyroid stuff, menopause is huge. Rare things like Cushing's, but what else are some of the more common, you know, sort of organic, I guess, medical issues?
Yeah, anxiety, depression, mm-hmm. from a psychological mm-hmm. standpoint. And then another big thing I see is PCOS. I have it myself. So when people with PCOS often have some sort of insomnia issue, so we're treating that if we can. What else? It could be anything, honestly. I see a lot of patients in treatment from cancer. Sometimes some of the medications they're on can cause some of the issues. Chronic pain issues. I have a lot of patients with fibromyalgia.
Yeah, pain. That's a big one. That's a big one. And Spencer, you probably see that too. I mean, you know, we have people who are, they don't sleep because it hurts. I mean, I remember before I had my hips replaced, that was part of my problem.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, a lot of people assume too that you then think of the sleep issue as a secondary problem. But what we often do, especially when it's insomnia, we think about it as a comorbidity. So it's they're co-occurring issues. So we try to treat the sleep stuff that's going on, whether it's behaviorally, medication, whatever, while you're also addressing the pain. And sometimes if we can improve the sleep, even while not directly improving the pain, you sleep a little bit better, that can help with pain tolerance. And sometimes people will sleep deeper with CBT for insomnia or whatever treatment we're doing, so they're not waking up as much, feeling the pain, their sleep is deeper.
Yeah, interesting.
Everybody talks about CBT for insomnia. What does that entail?
Yeah. So CBTI it's really the gold standard treatment for insomnia.
What does it stand for, first of all? Because people are going to think we're talking about cannabis.
Yes, exactly. I hear that all the time. Cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia. And people often think that it's somewhat similar to other kinds of psychotherapies, but it's actually quite different in many other respects. So CBT in general was developed for anxiety, depression in the 70s and is used. I use it with patients all the time. But when it comes to insomnia, it's a bunch of different modules that were essentially separate treatments that were used for insomnia. And then they figured out, let's combine them all and use them when we need to with certain patients. And we increase the effectiveness if we combine all the modules. So the modules, sleep hygiene is the basic that we always just do. But like I said, it doesn't really move the needle. But if someone's drinking a 2-liter bottle of Diet Coke at bedtime, nothing else is going to work. So we make sure that that's, you know, out of the picture. And then we'll work on stimulus control. So like the limiting of the bed for sleep and sex, or just like quieter times and knowing when to get out, when to stay in. And then sleep restriction is the other big one. So the name of it is terrible. I hate the name sleep restriction, but it's essentially time in bed restriction. So you're limiting your time in bed based on sleep diaries that we've been taking, tracking your sleep for a few weeks, based on how much sleep you're getting on average. Because there's often a mismatch between how much sleep someone's getting at night and then the amount of time they're in bed. So if they're only getting 6 hours at night, but they're in bed 8-9 hours at night, that's part of the problem. So we actually significantly limit the time in bed to that. And then I teach people ways to understand, now is your sleep consolidated enough? Can we start going to bed earlier? And then we start increasing the total sleep time. And then we also work, if we need to, on cognitive issues or the cognitive module, which will be like challenging people's thoughts about sleep. If I don't sleep tonight, all these bad things are going to happen tomorrow. Well, is there evidence behind it?
That was me.
So what's the evidence behind it? If there is actual evidence, then we got to figure out how to problem solve it. But a lot of times at 3 a.m, the rational part of our brain isn't there. And we're just going like black and white thinking. So it's teaching people ways to really challenge the thoughts and the pressure they're putting on themselves to sleep, whether it's challenging them during the day, writing coping cards, ways to work on your worries, because a lot of times it's not even sleep related. It's just they're worrying about anything and everything. So we might help people with some of that stuff. And then mindfulness techniques. So I work a lot with patients on doing mindfulness during the day to help them learn to let go of busy thoughts. And then maybe some relaxation exercises if we need to. Sometimes we'll use light therapy with some people if indicated. But it's like, it's very behavioral in nature. And then we add in some of the cognitive stuff. And it's short term. I mean, I work with people usually between 4 to 8, 4 to 12 sessions. The longer times are when people are on like on a lot of sleep aids that they need to get off of. So we're tapering them off of it while doing therapy.
Speaking of that, let's go through some of this. So the like kind of the over-the-counter stuff and maybe even some sleep medicines that people may be familiar with. So obviously everyone wants to learn more about the use of over-the-counter melatonin. What's the actual benefits? When should it be used? How much? Kids, adults, all that stuff.
So melatonin is the bane of my existence because it's everywhere online. But it's interesting. It's almost become vilified. Like I'll see so many things like melatonin free. Melatonin actually has data behind it. I use it in my practice, but the way that we use it in sleep medicine is totally different from how it's marketed. So we use like a half a milligram to 1 milligram, very low dose. You go to the market, you'll see like 10 milligrams higher on the Kusha. We use tiny doses many hours before you're going to bed to help shift your sleep-wake timing. So that's when we use it for circadian rhythms, shifting. But it's not really effective for most people who have insomnia. So when people are coming to me like, I take 5 milligrams, I take 10 milligrams. I've had people taking 40 milligrams of melatonin. There's no research and no if you're needing to take more than 3, it's not working for you. So people are using it wrong. We also use it for certain things like REM behavior disorder, which is a more unusual disorder, but it's like you're acting out your dreams. You can get violent in your sleep. It's actually a first-line treatment for that. But it's really circadian rhythm disorders and REM behavior, not insomnia and low doses and timed properly.
And do you still use it for like jet lag? Because of that circadian rhythm.
That falls into the circadian rhythm. So jet lag, shift work. And with kids, actually, to answer that question too, low doses, we don't like to use it right off the bat with most kids because of the messaging and what you're doing. Like we just don't have, we don't like to. But there is, you know, if you've tried behavioral treatments, it can be, and it's still not working, it can be useful in the population. And we have research showing that it is effective and a very legitimate strategy for kids who are neurodivergent. So we actually do use it there routinely with those kids.
Spencer, I don't know if you do it like this, but so we do have like some melatonin, or we've had some melatonin gummies or these little melatonin things that are like 3 to 5 milligrams or something like that. And almost like to get our circadian rhythms back on for like the week sort of thing, we'll do that with the kids. Is that in the realm of reasonable? Because it was kind of based on that same rationale that I am familiar with, how it's just more of a circadian, obviously a circadian hormone, but
We always encourage people to like talk with their pediatrician first, and we try like, are there other strategies that we could be doing to get people onto that more routine pattern? But like I said, if nothing else is really working, then there is a legitimate use for it there. Yeah. And the other big problem is it's not regulated by the FDA. So
of course. Now, what about what people know as, you know, Benadryl, NyQuil, diphenhydramine, the antihistamine?
ZQuil. So that, it's funny, a lot of people for years were being told by primary care, like, take Benadryl, it's fine. Like, but in sleep medicine, we really don't love it because we know long-term use, it tends to lose its effectiveness over time. People start taking more. And then also we have research showing it can lead to cognitive issues down the road, greater risk of falls, accidents. Like I would actually rather someone take prescription medication than Benadryl because they can start taking more and more of it. And ZQuil is just the same thing. Just it's got the same active ingredients in it to make you fall asleep.
Okay. Unisom.
Unisom's similar. It's doxylamine, but it's interesting. Unisom, we don't recommend so much in sleep medicine, but it's used a lot in pregnancy to help with sleep because it is considered safe. So that's an area where we will actually use it with some patients.
I feel like crap if I take that stuff.
But that's the other big thing. Yeah, it can make you feel like when I take Benadryl, if I'm sick or something, which I feel horrible the next day.
Really bad. You know, some, once in a while, I'll take it almost in that sort of once in a while thing with the whole circadian rhythm thing. And sometimes I'll feel actually really well the next day. And then sometimes not so much. But so then here's an in-between question then. In-between over-the-counters and pharmaceuticals. What about actual THC, CBD?
CBD.
So the CBD, the non-psychoactive part, that it helps some people to just kind of chill out a little bit, but it's not really a sleep aid. I mean, I could count. I mean, no one comes to me in my practice having found that CBD is helpful for them. It's just, you know, kind of like magnesium is similar. It's like it helps to relax you.
That's so true, too. The magnesium glycinate people are, you know, having some pretty good benefits from. That's
exactly.
So like the CBD.
Yeah.
Okay. So CBD is kind of a chill out. What about THC then?
The THC is useful for some people, but again, there's no real consistency with where people are getting it from. I ask people all the time, like, what's in that? Do you know the dosage of the THC and the gummy you're taking? I don't know. Like, people are taking all different amounts. And also it tends to make people feel more groggy the next day. So we don't really love it in sleep medicine also because we just find that it's not helping people feel the most restorative sleep a lot of times. Some people swear by it. But most of the time we're like, try and stay away from it just because of the daytime impacts, memory issues. Some people are reporting with it. And then, like I said, like standardization of dosing is a problem. And also like the gummies sometimes take like 3 hours to work for someone. So like you're having, some people are timing out their evening, taking the gummy at a certain time to then be home to get sleepy at that time. It's not ideal.
What about chamomile, lavender?
Yeah, same thing. Like they're just like, they help you chill out. Which is fine if you're noticing, but they're not in the of itself. They're not sleep aids for, I say if it helps you to relax, great.
What about the more powerful stuff like Ambien?
Yeah. And so where are we in that world right now? Cause I mean, I would do like almost once a week where I would take an Ambien again to kind of get on my cycle. And then I'd wake up at like 4 a.m. and my whole week was set. I'd be good to go. But
I mean, the way I like to think about it, and a lot of my colleagues too, is like we think about it like a tiered approach, right? So we're always trying to start people with behavioral approaches that we know can work longer term where you're not relying on medication. If that's not working and we've ruled out other medical issues like apnea or other endocrine issues that might be impacting your sleep, then there is a place for sleep aids. It's just a matter of which sleep aid. And so Ambien, and these are all in like the newer benzo kind of class. So there's like Ambien, Sonata, Lunesta. They work well for some people. Other people, they're not as great for. And some people find, you know, they're not without side effects, right? So there is the risk of sleepwalking, sleep talking, sleep eating. That's why a lot of people come to me because they've had sleepwalking issues. They also might feel more groggy during the day. And then other classes of medication that are used really commonly would be like offish label antidepressants. So like trazodone.
Alopecin. Everyone's on trazodone. So I'm interested in that because a lot of my patients are on trazodone. What's the real evidence for that?
It's interesting. The research shows that it kind of works, but not great. But I mean, I see in my practice, it works really well for a lot of people.
Pretty safe.
Lower doses of trazodone. Safety-wise, it's been around for ages and people are using it at much lower doses. Just you're really using it for the sedating aspect, not for the higher doses that people used to take it for depression. Generally, it's pretty well tolerated. It's just a lot of people will have issues with the daytime drowsiness from it, and that's when people will stop taking it. Amitriptyline is another one, but usually it can have heart impacts. So we do usually when doctors are prescribing it, they're asking to have them just medically checked out before they are actually prescribing it. So there's the antidepressants. Then there's the newer class of medications that really essentially like Quviviq, Belsomra, Dayvigo. Those are essentially turning off the wake promoting hormone, the orexin, in your body. So you then, it like turns off that switch. So they work totally different than say Ambien and that class of like the benzos. Some people find them useful, some people not so much, and they still can have side effects. And then there's also, what else am I forgetting? gabapentin's really popular all of a sudden. So,
gabapentin.
That's interesting. Just well, because so many of my patients with diabetic neuropathy and stuff, you know, and they have other types of neuropathy, they're on gabapentin, and usually it's the side effect is sleepiness. But I suppose so. I guess I get that. But okay.
Yeah. So we'll use that. And then there's like, you know, sometimes people are taking things like Xanax, Ativan, those kinds, but we don't really love those in sleep medicine so much. Yeah.
So then falling asleep, then what about waking up? Same kind of treatment with CBT?
Similar. Yeah, like it's similar. So it would be the same thing. We're going to start with the behavioral treatment, or then we might use medications. And the problem is with the wake up ones is that then are you training someone to like always wake up and take a medication in the middle of the night? And then they're looking at the clock and how like, is it close enough to when I have to get up that I can't take it? But there are some that are used for middle of the night awakenings, just not as many.
Okay. Because yeah, I have a lot, it's a lot of my perimenopausal, but I mean, they're on hormone replacement therapy and they're not waking up hot. They just wake up and they're up. So yeah. I always just refer them to your book. Cause I'm like, I don't know what else to do.
Excuse me while I'm trying to plug in my computer.
Well, good. But yeah, I mean, a lot of it too is there can be a million reasons why people are waking up at night. And talking about perimenopausal women, like sleep apnea, it's so common, and that's often a reason why people are having very broken sleep, disrupted sleep at night, and they're not getting evaluated because they don't have the stereotypical look of sleep apnea, yet they completely have it. And that can be one other thing that we need to roll out.
Interesting. Very cool. All right. What else do we need to ask? I mean, kind of covered everything.
I think, you know, and we've had a lot of episodes where we talk about, you know, in our world, why sleep is so important. You covered those basics. I mean, we could probably have about 20 episodes as to why. I mean, it is so important for people to be able to engage in their nutrition, their exercise, their cognitive abilities during the day. It is important for our circadian rhythm-based hormones in my world. You know, people talk about cortisol and the sleep-wake cycle and all that stuff. So what are some of the most obvious myths out there, the misinformation, and maybe it does have to do because, you know, we've talked a lot about the cortisol misinformation by, you know, some people who'd say you're not allowed to exercise first thing in the morning because your cortisol and all that stuff. And we talked about how, no, just make sure you're getting good sleep, good nutrition. You know, that's the most important part. Cortisol being up is important. But what are some of those myths that we need to bust?
The cortisol thing drives me mad because it does. Like, cortisol is too high in the middle. And I'm like, so what are you going to do about that? Like, and then they start taking all these supplements.
I was going
to
say, what are they going to do? They need to come see me and just figure out why they have a pituitary adrenal tumor that's making too much cortisol. That's actually
exactly the case. Exactly. Or that it's not actually because of cortisol and they're just like saying that's what's going through their vein. Yeah. So there's that. The 8-hour myth we're spending, like, it's just really, it makes it harder for a lot of people.
The Aura rings are making people.
Ooh, that's a great question. The Aura ring thing, because I have wondered about the legitimacy of that. That great one, Spencer.
Jeez. So, yeah. So what we know of in practice and in research is that they're beneficial for people who don't make sleep a priority in their lives. So if you're someone who's burning the candle at both ends, you're drinking a lot of alcohol at night, you're kind of inconsistent sleep patterns, fine. It will highlight those sleep hygiene sort of things for you. Sometimes an Aura ring will tell us, like, if someone's, it's not a sleep study. It is not a substitute for a sleep study, but it will tell us, like, if someone's oxygen is dropping a lot at night, it might be a little like sign that maybe there's some apnea going on, things like that. But what we do find is that when people have sleep problems, the rings, the trackers are actually making them worse. So I, every single day in my practice nowadays, I have someone that I spot with an Aura ring on or whatever it might be. And I'm just like, is that actually helping you to sleep more? And they said, well, not really. And then I said, does it gauge how your day is going to go for you if you had good data or bad data? And then they say, yes. And they say, get rid of it. I want you to just trust in yourself a bit more because it's causing this hyper focus on their sleep. That really, that's part of the problem with people who have sleep problems. They're too focused on it that we need to pull that away more. So is it helping you or hurting you? If you already have a sleep disorder and it's not changing anything, I say get rid of it.
is there some legitimate has it been validated? Aura rings even work? I guess I don't understand how they work and if they actually work. Is the data actually real?
Yeah. So a few of my colleagues, like Kathy Goldstein's one of them, they're great sleep medicine colleagues who are actually doing a lot of research in this area and had a few papers out recently within the past year on it. They're really great for duration of sleep. So how much sleep and sleep timing. So they're actually pretty good with that. They're getting better. They're not perfect. They're getting better with the sleep staging. So, but the problem is that when we're looking at sleep staging, so like deep sleep, light sleep, REM, those are very generalized kind of terms. And we don't always know how each company is, what they're using. Like Apple Watch says core sleep. Like we don't even fully know what that means. We have our suspicions. So, because we don't use that term in sleep medicine. So they're getting better with it. But the other thing is like, if you have the data that says I'm not getting enough REM sleep or I'm getting too much, what are you going to do with it? Because I think people don't take into account that a lot of times the alcohol or even medications that people are taking, a lot of people are on SSRIs and various medications that are changing their sleep-wake staging for a good reason, that they don't know how to interpret the data.
Yeah, that goes to a lot of the things we talk about in this podcast, because people are spending a ton of money getting a bunch of inappropriate labs by people who don't know what to do with them, and like continuous glucose monitors and people who don't need them at all. And we always say in medicine, if you're going to test something, you need to know why you're testing, what you're looking for, and what are you going to do with the results? How's it going to change management? So that's a great kind of final thought on that whole thing to me. Yeah, great.
Perfect. All right, so let's not get sued by Aura Ring.
but hey, I'm happy to hear that there is some legitimate validity to it. Because I didn't know at all. I was like, I have no idea if these things do anything. I thought
they had their place. I'm not against them in the least. Like, I've done Whoops podcasts. Like, I think they're actually fantastic. But the problem is it's the people with the specific sleep disorders are the ones seeking them out. And that's not the population that really would benefit the most from them.
Very good. Well, this is amazing. What's your book called? So all of our patients and followers can get it.
I have two. So two. The original, the main one is The Women's Guide to Overcoming Insomnia.
That's the one I send people to.
That's the one that most people
Yeah, and that's the one you gave to Spencer. Okay.
There you go. I will send you one too if you'd like. And then I have another one that just came out with two co-authors. It's The Essential Guide to Children's Sleep. So, if your kids aren't sleeping well, good luck sleeping yourself.
Yeah.
There you go.
Nice.
Very good. Well, thanks so much for coming on. We'll make sure that your book and your Instagram, where you put all sorts of good stuff, is listed in the show notes for anybody that has a friend or family member or anyone else that has insomnia or sleep issues. Make sure you send them this podcast. Make sure you give us a 5 out of 5 since it helps us. Don't, like I always say, go to hell. Don't even review us. Thanks. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you,
Shelby, as always. Very good. Here is our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.